I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Calling it one of the most important steps forward in environmental policy in the last decade, the Hogan administration yesterday announced an agreement on new rules to stem pollution of the Chesapeake Bay by Eastern Shore poultry farms. Rona Cabell of the Bay Journal will be with us for the second hour of today's show to talk about what the new rules mean for chicken farming in Maryland. Up front, as spring approaches, we look back at Baltimore's efforts to house the city's homeless during the harsh winter months. And we get a status report on the stated goal of making homelessness in Baltimore rare and brief. Plus, we hear from some of the hundreds of people who spend their days on the street. Midday starts after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks with you. Thanks again for joining us, making Midday part of your day. Is Baltimore doing enough to reduce homelessness? In 2008, then-Mayor Sheila Dixon launched the Journey Home, a plan with a lofty goal of ending homelessness within 10 years. Now entering its eighth year, the Journey Home's estimated 3,000 people in Baltimore still experience homelessness on any given night. As we come out of an especially brutal winter, we get a progress report on the city's stated goal to make homelessness rare and brief. Earlier this year, the Department of Housing and Urban Development announced that it would issue Maryland a grant of $48 million for homeless services. Baltimore City will receive just a little less than half of that. About $22 million will be awarded to 32 different homeless service organizations throughout the city. At this point, the city has only been awarded the grant by HUD, but expects to receive the money in the coming months. Later on in this hour, we'll speak to Adrian Breedenstein, executive director of the Journey Home, and Jeff Singer, social worker and former CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless, and get a progress report on Baltimore's struggle to end homelessness. But first, tomorrow marks the first day of spring, even though the weather forecast isn't great for spring. And for Baltimore's homeless population, this comes as a welcome change, particularly this winter. The city received almost 2 feet of snowfall and had 7 code blue warnings for extreme cold temperatures issued by the health department. Throughout the state, 21 cold weather-related deaths were reported. At least 4 were identified as homeless individuals. The bitter weather we experienced these past months exhausted Baltimore's 15 homeless shelters, which can house close to 1,200 people. The city was forced to open an auditorium in the Baltimore War Memorial as an emergency overflow shelter. We'll start our discussions today just taking a look at and hearing about the day-to-day struggles of the homeless in Baltimore with Mike Sipe, executive director of the Baltimore Station, a recovery program for veterans who are in transition through poverty, addictions, and homelessness. And Mike, nice to have you on the show. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Dan. Good to see you again.
Haven't seen you in a while. At Baltimore Station, in addition to operating from your base in the old firehouse in South Baltimore on West Street, you have a Monument Street operation.
We do. It's called the Overflow Shelter. So when the city's primary facility on Fallsway reaches maximum, then we open our facility on Monument Street to up to 120 men. And over the winter months, we got as high as 170 actually there.
Wow.
How
did you accommodate 170 when you're set up for 120? You actually have 120 beds.
We have 120 beds. The city was able to find us some additional cots, and we had mats on the floor. And you have 7 days of sub-freezing weather in a row, it's better to sleep on a mat on the floor and know that you're going to get a hot cup of coffee in the morning than be out on the street.
But doesn't that tell us also that there are people who are only forced indoors by, or only have an opportunity to come indoors when the weather is severe like that?
That's absolutely.
Either by choice or no choice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go into many parts of Baltimore. In fact, a block and a half from our program on West Street, there's an abandoned warehouse. Any given night, you can find 15 to 20 guys living in that warehouse.
What is your building like on Monument Street? What is that building?
It's actually an old motel that the city renovated into sort of a suite of cots. It's very minimal. We serve breakfast in the morning. Guys come around between 7 and 7:30 at night. They leave between 6 and 7 in the morning, unless it's code blue. If it's code blue, then they're there 24/7.
And we had, what did I say, 7 code blue
alerts.
Alerts,
but,
yeah.
But on some of those alerts, they extended for over a whole week period, which is unusual for Baltimore.
I wanted to share with you and our listeners some good news on homelessness. I guess the numbers are down. Generally, nationally, we have various census that are done on homeless people in the United States. HUD reporting, in 2014, they counted 587,000 homeless people across the country on a single night. They do these one night counts, right? And that's a drop of about 10% over the past 5 years. And homeless veterans, which is the area you've been focused on, Mike, at South Baltimore Station, those numbers are down, too, in the census that was done last November.
Yes.
Down a little bit.
They're down a little bit. Two things that are happening, I think. One is that we have a program called HUD-VASH, which is a combination of the VA and HUD working together to provide permanent housing. So we're able to have resources that last longer for vets in transition. Two, I think the outreach efforts that we've been able to develop, we're finding veterans faster when they become homeless, so they're not on the street as long, and we get them into the program. And just as an example, between October 1st and March 16th, in the past, between 2014 and 2015, we admitted 55 veterans into the homeless veterans into the Baltimore station. So the need is still there. I think we're just doing a better job in the delivery of services and finding the vets faster and getting them either into the HUD-VASH program or into a treatment program like the Baltimore station.
And you think that's going on elsewhere throughout the country?
Absolutely going out, yeah.
How has that affected in any way your funding? Because I know you get some funding from the Veterans Administration.
We do. A major piece of our funding is, and sadly, we've become a society enamored with metrics. So we now judge things on metrics. And the VA took a sort of snapshot of our program. They did this all programs across the country. They didn't single us out. And they said, well, your veteran population is low, so we're going to take away 40 of your veteran-funded beds. So a snapshot in time happened to be in the spring and summer when population's down anyway.
Right.
And then what we had this winter is 55 vets would not have been served. If the cuts had gone into effect in 2014, those 55 vets would not have been able to get services at the Baltimore station.
It seems a little quick. There's not much of an interval there between the survey and the metrics. Understand, the metrics rule.
Right, metrics. But
pennywise, pound foolish.
Yeah. Right.
You ought to tell folks while you're here a little bit about South Baltimore Station, which has been around since the late 80s, right?
We just have our 25th anniversary.
I posted a photograph on Facebook a little while ago I took it off your website, I hope that's okay, of the old fire station.
Right.
There's an old fire station on West Street that South Baltimore Station moved into, Mike Sipes' operation, and then you were able to put an addition on there.
Yeah, so we now have 90 beds there. Of those 90 beds, 68 are reserved for homeless veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And the men can come in and they can stay for up to 2 years. Actually, we've had some men stay for four and a half years, depending on their physical conditions. But during that time period, they work first on their addiction, moving into recovery. And then once we get them there, we begin to focus on physical health, mental health issues. And then we look at education, employment, family reunification. And then they graduate into, permanent housing and hopefully or given back to society after a period of time.
People listening to our show, Mike, who drive around the Beltway, going about their business today, maybe going out to lunch or something, or drive around Baltimore, go on the Fallsway before they hit 83 and go north, right? I wonder, what are all those people doing there? Why are they homeless? I don't ever stop to ask why. I'm not that kind of person. Or maybe I see one on a median strip asking for money, holding up a cardboard sign. I wonder, really, what's the story there? Why is that woman homeless? What can you tell us about the veterans you've seen over the years at South Baltimore Station?
Well, it's a mix of why people are homeless, but homelessness is a symptom of something much deeper that's taken place in the person's life. If you look at the overflow shelter on Monument Street, we do informal surveys every couple months. Over half of the homeless men that are using the overflow have what's called co-occurring disorders. So they have an addiction, plus they have a mental health issue. It might be paranoid schizophrenia, bipolar, something like that. They become dysfunctional in their ability to manage their life because of the brain disorders that they're dealing with. The other 45% or so are there primarily for financial reasons. They became unemployed. They were no longer able to afford the rent. They were evicted, and they're out on the street.
They by themselves, single men? Single men mostly?
That's who we deal with,
who were what prior to being homeless, renting somewhere?
Yeah, most of them are renting, although we have some individuals, particularly veterans, who were evicted out of, they were homeowners and they were evicted. And
they lost their homes during the recession in
right.
particular?
You know, yes.
This has been a long slog there through the recession in terms of foreclosures, housing problems that people have had, loss of wealth, whatever assets people had.
And so we're still there.
You saw a lot of that.
We saw a lot of it. And I would argue from our vision of society, our view of society, that population is not healing from the recession. The trickle down, there is no trickle down to the lowest economic classes. They're all living on the edge every day. And when you live on the edge and you fall off, you're into homelessness.
Right.
But our brand of capitalism that we currently are looking at in this country, which is financial capitalism as opposed to market capitalism, is not creating the jobs we need.
Well, it sounds also like some of the men you see at South Baltimore Station and maybe on the Monument Street shelter who come in there may not be employable for health or mental health reasons, right?
Yes. So we graduated successfully about 65% of the guys that come into the station, and about 30% of them leave on some type of disability.
Mm-hmm. When you say graduate, how do you get to graduate from South Baltimore Station? What do you need for that diploma?
The big thing is recovery, that you've achieved a state of recovery. And you have built a support network outside of the station so that when you leave, you know, maybe it's through a church, maybe it's through family reunification, maybe it's through AA or NA, but you have a group of people that you are moving into. So you're moving from one social group into the next social group.
And have you done, you and your staff there at South Baltimore Station, done some work on family reunification, veterans who... You know, homeless partly, as you said, it's a symptom, and it may be a symptom of a dysfunctional home life or addiction that caused somebody to be alienated from family members. So could you talk a little bit about that aspect?
Yeah, most of the addicts that we see who have become homeless are chronic. I mean, they've been at it for a long time, and they've burned most of their bridges with their friends and their family. One of the things that we try and do as we go through the therapeutic process is to get them to acknowledge that if they're going to succeed in recovery, they have to at least make contact with and deal with the people that they did damage to during this process. Some of them are very successful, and they rekindle relationships with their children, spouses, mothers, fathers.
Do your relatives actually come to the shelter and talk to them?
Occasionally, but more often we will push that outside.
Off-site?
Off-site.
Right. So, Mike Sipe, thanks for being here today to talk about this. I wonder, what do you do about the shortfall in veterans funding? How much does that hurt you going forward here in 2015?
Well, we're going to fight it.
Yeah, so you're okay, so you got to notice
We got a notice. We're not going to accept the VA's sort of mandate that they want to cut. I mean, we're going to go to our volunteers, our base of support, our congressional delegation. Jack Young has said he'll help us, so we're going to figure out how to not allow that to happen.
This is a city council president. So it's Mike Sipe, S-I-E-P-P, who's been at this for quite a while, executive director of the Baltimore Station, the program he was just describing. It's on West Street in the old firehouse with the addition in South Baltimore that people who go into Ravens games might walk right by sometimes, right?
All the time, yeah. Right.
And in addition, 120-bed facility on Monument Street and another location on Baker Street in West Baltimore, right?
Correct, yeah.
Thanks for being here, Mike.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, good luck. Stay in touch. All right, folks, our program, our hour here devoted to homelessness continues. When we return, Adrian Breedenstein, executive director of The Journey Home, Baltimore's official plan to end homelessness, will be here, as well as Jeff Singer, a social worker and former president of Healthcare for the Homeless. They'll be joining us in just a minute. If you have any comments or questions, give us a ring, 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. At any point in time, as many as 3,000 people in Baltimore are homeless. This winter, at least 4 cold weather-related deaths were of homeless people in Baltimore. In this hour, what is Baltimore doing? How are we progressing in terms of moving people out of homelessness, the stated goal to end homelessness as we know it, or to at least make homelessness rare and brief, which is an adjustment of that lofty goal of ending homelessness. Adrian Breidenstein is with us today. Adrian Breidenstein is executive director of this plan Baltimore City has to end homelessness. It's called The Journey Home. Nice to have you on the show, Adrian. Nice to meet you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And Jeff Singer is back with us, social worker, professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and former CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless.
Yes, thank you. Good to
Jeff,
hear you.
What's that noise I'm hearing? Oh, I'm sorry, folks. Pardon the interruption. I just heard some tapping noise or something, and it's not Jeff. It's not you, is it?
No,
it was coming from your area of the studio. Anyway, sorry about that. Nice to have you back on the show, Jeff.
Good to be here.
I first knew Jeff when Healthcare for the Homeless was on Park Avenue in Baltimore. How many years were you there at HCH?
Well, I was there for 25 years.
25 years. And then now you're teaching at the University of Maryland School of Social Work.
Yes, and doing a little organizing.
Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So, Adrian, let's start with something here. The number 3,000, let's start with that. It's sort of the operative working number that we use. That's based on a census the city took this past winter or this past year?
So that's based on a homeless point-in-time count that we took in 2013. We did conduct another point-in-time count the beginning of this year. We are in the process of calculating those numbers. But yeah, you know, every other year we do a point-in-time count where we have over 300 volunteers go out and canvass the streets of Baltimore City to try and get a count of the number of people experiencing homelessness on any given night in Baltimore City. Now, I will say, I want to be really clear, we don't consider this by any means an accurate count of the number of people who experience homelessness on any given night. I think, Michael's example of how, you can go across the street and find an abandoned home where 15 or abandoned building where 15 people are staying. Those people are often overlooked when we're doing point in time counts. So I want to be clear that this is not an accurate count. We really look at this as an estimate and try to look at it over time. It can help to be sort of a temperature check as to how we're doing to address homelessness.
Okay, I understand the number better now. It's what your volunteers can come up with on a particular night.
Right.
So you acknowledge it's probably an undercount.
Indeed.
And Jeff, I mean, you've been at this a long time, as we just pointed out here. How much of an undercount do you think it is? Is it possible to even speculate on that?
It's possible to speculate. There's good research. Kim Hopper is a very well-known anthropologist, been working on homelessness for 40 years. He did a study in New York City, found that the undercount that he could address was about 40%. About 40% of people that he planted in the city to be homeless were not counted by the people doing the count, same as the people in Baltimore. So a 40% undercount is one way to look at it.
Okay. And Adrian, one thing I wanted to say about you is you took this job in September 2013.
Yes.
And Sheila Dixon, who was mayor of Baltimore in 2008, announced this plan to end homelessness in that year. And am I correct that your job is full-time as executive director?
It is.
Prior to that, there wasn't anyone really in charge of the plan full-time?
No, there was not anyone in this position prior to me getting here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, that's an improvement, I would say, having somebody full-time, one would assume.
Well, particularly having Ms. Bridenstine.
Yeah, Bridenstine, Adrian Bridenstine. Okay, so let's talk about what the city has. Since we have a number there that we acknowledge is a low number, what does the city actually offer on any given night for people who spend the day homeless and need a place to sleep? Let's start with that.
So there are a network of homeless service providers across the city, and they provide a range of services anywhere from emergency shelter, as Michael was talking about earlier, to treatment programs, to permanent housing. The real focus is on getting people into permanent housing. And we've really redoubled our efforts to do that over the past years. Couple years. Since 2011, we've actually seen a 64% increase in the number of permanent supportive housing beds that are available for people experiencing homelessness in Baltimore. That has allowed us to serve over 300 people more each year by putting them into housing.
So those people that fall into that category, they got vouchers of some kind to pay for rent? Is that what happened?
So permanent supportive housing is a lifetime rental subsidy. We really try to target permanent supportive housing to people who are experiencing chronic homelessness or people who are really, really vulnerable, so they're very sick. You know, they have comorbidity and most likely to die prematurely on the street. Hmm. So we really try. It's a very intensive type of intervention by providing. It provides that permanent subsidy, but it also provides the support services, which are critical to helping somebody remain housed.
So that's an increase, you said, of about 300 situations like that?
We've increased the number of beds by 64%, which has allowed us to serve 300 more people per year.
Okay. And then in terms of what's considered temporary, meaning I need a place to stay tonight, what do the numbers look like there?
So I think you highlighted them earlier. They're the emergency shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where people
can
go.
That's the Weinberg building on Fallsway?
That is one of many emergency shelters across the community. That's the largest in Baltimore City.
And for that purpose, there are about how many beds there and elsewhere?
There, I believe there are 275 beds. That's not including overflow, so additional beds that we use during Code Blue events.
Yeah, and Code Blue, we can get up to how many, would you say?
For Code Blue, we add an additional 175 beds for men and women, so we get up to about 1,300 beds across the city.
Jeff, I asked this question of Mike Sipe about why people become homeless, and I don't ever want to get deeply into this conversation, talking about numbers, but we're actually talking about individuals a little bit here.
Sure.
And actually, we're going to hear from some, because we went out and talked to some. Our producer, Connor Graham, went out and interviewed a couple of homeless people this past week. So we will hear their voices. Okay. But, I mean, your experience, and Adrian, please feel free to add to this, why people become homeless. Mike Sipe touched on a little bit from what he sees at South Baltimore Station over the years, and more recently, what do you see, Jeff?
Fundamentally, homelessness is poverty without a key to your own place. We talk about three reasons that people are homeless. They're poor. Almost everybody who's homeless is desperately poor. There's a lack of affordable housing. There's a terrible gap between people's incomes and the available rental housing. And people need services, and there aren't enough services. If we solve those three problems, we'd end homelessness.
There's a gap even with, say, being able to rent a room.
Oh, yes. I wanted to focus more on the housing part, and I'll let
Adrian. Well, we will during this. We have a whole hour here.
Homelessness part.
But, I mean, what about that in particular? Even to be able to afford a room in a house that somebody's
renting. If you're completely and totally disabled in the state of Maryland, while you're waiting to get federal benefits, you might get state benefits. It might be for a couple of years. The state benefit's $185 a month. Just look through the ads in the paper. There's no room available in the city of Baltimore for $185 per month.
Mm-hmm.
Even once you get federal benefits, you get $730 a month, and you can't afford to rent even an efficiency apartment with that income. So without a housing subsidy, we have tens of thousands of households and individuals in Baltimore who can't rent a place affordably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Jeff's you know, really touching on such an important issue, which is that we have an affordable housing crisis in this country and in this community. And this crisis is creating the problem of homelessness in a way that's faster than we can solve it. And until we, you know, see reinvestment in public housing and in subsidies, we, Baltimore and communities across the country, are going to continue to grapple with making homelessness rare and brief.
Well, in Baltimore City, since we're talking about that plan and the journey home, has there been any additional public housing that's come online?
Yes. I mean, the increase that I mentioned earlier, the 64% increase in permanent supportive housing, that is a result of a set aside of public or Section 8 vouchers that we get from the Housing Authority. We got an additional 500 vouchers in 2012, and then just this past year, we added another 150 to that. So we now have 650
I understand vouchers. I'm talking about actual physical buildings that are considered public housing in Baltimore. So are we doing anything more there?
May I quote from the Housing Authority's 2016 plan, which they just released? The net loss of public housing units predicted is 59. So they're reducing the supply of public housing. That doesn't count the ones they're privatizing, which is 2,000 units.
Yes, the last time you were on the show, we were talking about that plan to privatize some of the public housing in Baltimore City. That plan is going forward,
yes,
as far as we know.
It is.
Okay, so is the push there then in the housing management in Baltimore City toward more vouchers, just to try to find people willing to rent to people with vouchers?
It is, and I think that's rather unfortunate, because the Section 8 dollars don't really go as far as the public housing dollars. We prefer that the city spent their money on creating, maintaining good public housing, housing that all of us own, that will never be used for a profit for someone.
Do you sit on the board of the Journey Home?
I did.
You did, okay.
But I don't anymore.
You don't anymore. But the Journey Home has a board. And Adrian, does the board have a position on what else Baltimore should be doing, addressing Jeff's point about, and my question, about actual permanent physical places that the city builds as public housing?
So the board does not have a position specifically on what Jeff is talking about. What the board is trying to explore is how do we create more affordable housing opportunities for people experiencing homelessness. Does it mean that we need to look at, you know, creating more subsidies? Does it mean, certainly we do need to look at create development. I mean, that's got to be, it's got to be a multi-pronged solution. But I would say that that is something that we're still exploring, and we're working with a lot of community partners, not just people who are represented on the board, to figure out what is the best solution for creating affordable housing opportunities for people experiencing homelessness.
You're listening to Midday here on WYPR. Adrian Bridenstine, Executive Director of the Journey Home, Baltimore's official plan to end homelessness. I keep saying to end homelessness, and it sounds like such a lofty goal. I guess that should be our ambition. Homelessness is a blot on our society that we have it here in this very wealthy country that we live in. It doesn't seem realistic to most people when they hear that, although I think they admire the ambition. Was that adjusted over to rare and brief?
No.
Those were the original words, always been rare and brief?
Jeff can talk about this. I know he was around back then when the development of this plan was happening, but Baltimore was really intentional when we made that our vision to make homelessness in Baltimore rare and brief, acknowledging the fact that we know we're never going to prevent a housing crisis for anyone. But when we do, we want to make sure that we are quickly getting people back home.
Jeff, you want to talk about that a minute? I mean, we have to adjust our sights here. The landscape seems to have changed a bit since 2008 it was? Well, actually, that was during the recession. So the recession made things harder.
During Bush 2.
Bush 2,
the
yeah.
federal government decided that cities should have 10-year plans to end homelessness. That's what they called them. And Baltimore was one of the cities that created one of these plans. But we who were involved in creating it, yes, that was our goal, to end homelessness permanently, but we'd like to try to get it to be rare and brief in a practical way. And in fact, we know we can, but not under current circumstances, not when HABC is reducing the supply of public housing. That's counter to the need.
So seems to be a split there in the idea between providing vouchers for people and sending them out to find a place to stay, right? Or giving them help in doing that, or actually building some public housing or some affordable housing in Baltimore City. I could say affordable housing, which would be what? Something a nonprofit maybe develops or a developer develops because of some obligation that he has to the city.
It could. You know, across the state, half of the housing vouchers that are issued to needy families are returned because you can't find landlords willing to accept them. We've been in Annapolis for years trying to make it illegal to discriminate against people who are using a voucher to pay for their housing. But that legislation hasn't been adopted.
So it's not illegal to do that?
No.
Landlord has that right of refusal?
There are a few jurisdictions in Maryland. Baltimore's not one of them.
I wanted to ask this question, too, because I'm always curious about when I go out and actually interview people who are homeless, I wonder, why are they still out on the street? You know, because I know the shelter is over there in the Fallsway, right near the Baltimore Sun building. I see people, and I stop and talk to them sometimes, and it's, you know, it's getting pretty cold, and I wonder, why don't you go over to the Fallsway, to the Weinberg building? And, you know, it's never clear to me whether the answer just doesn't seem rational, although sometimes it's, you know, I don't like it there. I hear people say that. So you can't really force people off the street. I think some of our listeners may wonder, what's the law? What's the policy? What are the rules when it comes to people who are in tents, for instance, or even aren't in tents on a very cold winter night?
So there is no law or anything that says that we have to make people go in and accept shelter. People have the right to make that decision if they want to go or if they want to stay in the streets. But fundamentally, we don't have enough shelter beds. I mean, that's the big issue. And I think when we opened War Memorial, this showed a perfect example of it. When we opened War Memorial on those cold nights, on average, it was 200 people in there every night that were coming in. We don't open War Memorial 24 hours a day, 365
right.
days a week.
And Mike Sipe said he had up to 170 in a place with 120 beds for overflow, which highlights the need out there, mm-hmm. right, that is not being met on a regular night.
But I must add that the city also has a policy, maybe it's informal, to destroy encampments and make it harder to do outreach to them. Now, this isn't done all the time and for every encampment, but we've had very good examples of how destroying encampments makes it more difficult to help people get into permanent housing.
So I do want to clarify, the city, that is not an official policy of the city that we will go and destroy encampments. We are actually working very closely with street outreach teams. You know, city agencies do go to encampments to clean and remove trash and make sure that it's, you know, not a public health hazard, anything going on there. And we work very closely with the outreach teams there because we do know that when you do dismantle encampments, it is disruptive for not only the people who are living there, but for the outreach workers who are trying to engage people and get them connected to services.
But hasn't the city done that a couple of times? I mean, we actually removed an encampment that was near the Jones Falls Expressway, and then it happened a second time, I believe, right?
It has, yes.
Yeah, because of health issues, right?
Health issues?
Yeah.
No,
because, it was cited as being unsafe or unhealthy, no?
Since I've been in my role, it's not been city policy to dismantle encampments. It may have happened in the past, but
okay. So it hasn't happened since you took over September of 2013. Okay.
Right, Camp 83's destruction was before that.
Okay,
but I'll cite
What was the reason for Camp 83's destruction or uprooting?
The people commuting along the Jones Falls Expressway, particularly from Johns Hopkins East Baltimore campus, didn't like seeing the tent, so they prevailed upon the city to destroy it. And the folks there, we organized with them and tried to prevent that, and we were, of course, unsuccessful. But I'll cite another good example. Martin Luther King Day parade in 2011, the day before the parade, the city destroyed an encampment that was very visible on the parade route. Had nothing to do with health. I went there that evening, and all the people who had been staying in that encampment had returned to it, but now all their tents and belongings were gone.
Okay, so I just want to make it clear then, the policy today on those encampments is, let's just go over that before we take our next break, Adrian. I want to make sure I understand.
We are not looking to dismantle encampments. Right now, the city is just focused on cleaning and making sure that the areas remain safe and doing this in coordination with street outreach teams.
Okay, we'll take a break here. Adrian Bridenstine from The Journey Home, Baltimore's official plan to end homelessness. Jeff Singer, former CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless, Baltimore social worker who teaches at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, our guest in this hour at midday. Well, you're welcome to call in if you have comments or questions about the city's policy on homelessness and its efforts to end homelessness. 410 662 8780. Welcome back to Midday. Midday producer Karna Graham interviewed some homeless people outside St. Vincent de Paul Church on Front Street near Fayette Street. He spoke to a man named Winston. Winston spoke about how tough it was to be homeless, especially during this past brutal winter, and why he avoids going to shelters.
This was a rough winter. We hadn't had a winter like this in a while. I wasn't prepared for it. Didn't sometime have the proper coat and shoes, socks and things. It was a rough winter. It was a rough winter. I'm a guy that don't do the shelters a lot. Really don't like them. I will go in them, but don't like them. No disrespect to them. Some of them not clean. Some of the people that come in them don't clean themselves. It makes it a little hard sometimes for, not that I'm the cleanest person, but, you know, it makes it hard sometimes.
So he doesn't like to go into shelters, but nonetheless, we asked him what he thought of the city's efforts, if he thought the city was doing enough to help the homeless.
Enough? No. Honestly, no. But they help. They helped me get this far, you know what I mean? They didn't just kick me out on the street. They fed me. Salvation Army truck comes. There's a lot of places to eat. So it's not that bad, really. You know, the city do their part. It's up to you to do yours.
Let's listen to another individual, this one named Michael, who spoke to Connor the other day. Now, Michael says he became homeless after he lost his job, which is a common thing to hear. He says that it's hard to find space in the shelters.
I used to live over in Pigtown. I used to rent a room in a house, row house over there. My brother's company folded up because of the economy. I couldn't pay the rent anymore, and I've been out on the streets since, staying at shelters, outside, whatever. I don't see no end to it. I'm trying to get my food stamps and all back now, so I at least have something for the time being. But last summer I was picking up odd jobs here and there and supporting myself that way. This winter, mainly I've been flying a sign on street corners panhandling. The shelters are full of people that receive disability checks every month, and that makes it hard for people that don't have anything to find space. I know one guy that gets like $2,700 a month, and he's living in a shelter. You know, if I could just get the $760 or whatever it is for the regular disability, I wouldn't care if I had to spend all of it to keep a roof over my head, I would.
Hey, can we talk about benefits for a minute? Jeff Singer, you mentioned the number 185. Tell us what that represents in Maryland.
That's the state's temporary disability program for people who are completely and totally disabled.
Okay. Now, if you're a single male, not disabled,
yes,
like Michael, unemployed, yes, what are you eligible for? He mentioned food stamps, SNAP program.
But not since 1989 has Maryland had a program to help folks who are not disabled and who can't find a job and are not eligible for unemployment insurance.
For men
or
for women?
Anybody who doesn't have a dependent child.
Right.
Until 1989, we had a program.
Okay. So $185 is it if you're disabled. If you're in the situation of Michael...
Yeah.
Maybe you got unemployment benefits for a while, right? Because he said the company folded. What else is he eligible for? Anything?
Well, Medicaid.
Medicaid.
You can't pay your rent with Medicaid,
right,
but it's important.
Right. Okay. Because we are talking about housing and homelessness today. One more interview. This is Christopher. Christopher became homeless after being released from prison. He spent this past winter in a park, maybe the park over by St. Vincent de Paul Church, which is right there on at Fayette in front, near the post office. He says that it's safer than staying in a shelter.
I was released from prison, pretty much set homeless, went in program, got out of program, and now I'm on the streets fighting to get housing. And it's hard because you got all kinds of avenues you got to go up, and it's dangerous out here. There's me and one other guy that stayed in the park all winter, through all the snow, through everything. And I mean, people are nice enough. They come make sure you got plenty to eat. You know, you got warm clothes and stuff. They check on you all hours of the night. As it warms up, it gets more and more dangerous out here. So far, I don't see no help. I get food stamps. There's shelters I can go to, but it's more dangerous in the shelter, and you'll get robbed quicker in the shelter than you will on the street.
I don't know if, Adrian, you want to address that last comment about the Weinberg facility on the Fallsway. I mean, the people we talk to here have chosen, these three men have chosen not to go to shelters, but the shelters are full, correct?
Yes.
The city's shelter, the one I just referenced on Fallsway. What about crime and safety in the shelter?
I mean, that's an ongoing issue. There's crime and safety when you're living on the streets as well. I mean, it's not a safe environment. Living in shelters or on the streets is not a safe environment for anyone.
Let's take some phone calls. Adrian Bridenstine with us here from the Journey Home, Baltimore's plan to end homelessness. Jeff Singer, former CEO and president of Healthcare for the Homeless, Baltimore social worker, a long time street worker for the poor and for the homeless in Baltimore. Alice in Remington, thank you for holding. Go right ahead with your comments, please.
Hi there. So thanks for having me on. Yep. So I wanted to point out a couple things. One is that when there's development in a neighborhood and gentrification is taking place, I'm sorry, I just was pointing out salt on the sidewalk. I'm out of breath. When gentrification takes place, it raises the rents. And so even the substandard but affordable housing also gets the rents up. And so people become homeless as a result of gentrification. And you can see that in Remington. Another thing I would want to point out is that parishioners of mine who are homeless who went to the shelters this winter complained about three things. One thing was that the main shelter, they said during the day they had to be in a room. They weren't people who were on the regular programs. They had to be in a room that was small, and all the men were in one room. It was very smelly. I've been in that room. And there's a television set on all the time.
But where is that, Alice?
That was at the one that's right under the Fallsway.
Okay.
I think that's the Code Blue main one thing. And then two other things. One is about that one. In order to get a bed for the night, they have to go outside and stand in line. I don't remember if it's 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, but it takes several hours before they can be put on the bus for the overflow shelter. And then the third thing I would point out is that they must have been running out of money, because after an extended time of Code Blue, the food, the amount of food at the Code Blue shelter that was on Monument Street was getting very small. So they would be having perhaps a granola bar and a cup of either coffee or tea, depending on which day it was and what they'd made.
Alice,
so
thank you.
That would be breakfast.
All right, thank you. Let me hear from Adrian on that, her comments that she made about the Code Blue shelters.
So she is right. The Code Blue shelter, and it's actually called the Weinberg Housing and Resource Center. So at the Weinberg Housing and Resource Center, that is the central pickup spot for where men would line up to get onto a bus, and then they would be transported up to Monument Street.
Okay. I mean, she made a comment about the length of the wait. We hear comments about the conditions in the shelter. I don't know what to say about that. I'm not going to defend the shelter. I haven't been inside one for a year or two. So anything else you want to say about the conditions there? I don't know what to say about the fact that somebody smells who spent the day on the street. I mean, this is life, right?
I think it's all just symptoms of homelessness, and it's not the environment that we want people to be living in. There aren't access to showers or public restrooms across the city, so where are people going to find the time or the place to go to go and clean themselves up?
Mm-hmm. Adrian, you know, you were speaking before about increasing the number of permanent housing beds for people, permanent housing for people. If you can continue to get funds, I guess the plan now is to go the voucher route, short of the city building new housing, right, Jeff?
Well, I just want to clarify. So it's got to be a multi-pronged approach. It can't just be vouchers. That's not the only solution. It can't be just public housing. You know, both of those, I think, are ways to provide affordable housing opportunities for people experiencing homelessness. And we want to, you know, one of the great things about the vouchers is they're portable and people can use them to go and live in a neighborhood they want if a landlord will accept the voucher. Jeff makes a really good point. That's a problem that impacts all of our voucher programs, in particular the HUD-VASH program, the vouchers, the set-aside that I was talking about. We need landlords to be willing to accept these vouchers. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that, you know, landlords aren't aware of is these vouchers come with services attached to them. So we're not just putting somebody into a housing unit and not providing them the supports they need. They've got case management, which means they're going to have somebody checking in on them. They're going to have somebody that's connected them to a therapist. They're going to have somebody that's connecting them to community supports. All of those things are so critical to helping somebody integrate back into society and integrate back into a community and achieve stability.
But as what I'm saying is all those efforts, that's what would reduce the numbers. Money.
More housing. Right?
More affordable housing, yeah. Too, Jeff. Back to that issue.
Yes, and let's put to bed the notion that there is no money to solve these problems. There's plenty of money. Just two developments, Harbor East and Harbor Point, have cost the city $1 billion, and that money has gone to people who don't need it. And we don't need to be subsidizing people who don't need it. We could take that $1 billion and solve our homelessness problem pretty quickly.
Let's take another call. Dwayne in Curtis Bay. Dwayne, thanks for calling Midday.
Yeah, the gentleman who just made the point about Harbor East and Harbor Point, amen to that. Hmm. I'm a retired school teacher, Baltimore historian, used to live in Curtis Bay, but I've been homeless now for the last year and a half. I'm in a wheelchair, and I'm waiting for a hip replacement from the orthopedic clinic at Mercy Hospital. So in order to qualify for that, I'm staying at the Weinberg Center, and I've been quite an expert on that and the overflow situation that you all had mentioned. I've had to experience it almost every evening. The situation at Weinberg changed a good bit about a year ago when it changed from operation by what's called JHR, Jobs, Housing, and Recovery, when Catholic Charities took over last summer. The system is a little bit different. Almost every day they call the name of 3, 4, 5 slots that they have open, and a lot of times people are just not around to pick up the slots. The difference at the Weinberg Center now compared to before is you have a bed, you have the same people around you, it's a lot safer, a lot less problems. But it is true that there is a waiting list, and the waiting list is to what you call the overflow, which is a now converted motel over on Monument Street.
Dwayne, I want to just let you know we're short of time here, but I was curious about something.
Okay.
I asked this question, why someone is homeless. So you only have about a minute here. Would you mind telling us why did you become homeless?
I got homeless because I had a house in Curtis Bay for over 70 years that I inherited, and I got incarcerated for something I didn't do. And while I was gone, my father, who had Alzheimer's, wound up selling my house to a slumlord and forging my name. And now my house sits down there, abandoned and empty, and now I can't afford it. I would have had a house with no mortgage on it. But things happen. That's a personal problem that doesn't always happen
and
to other
so
people.
So is your plan is to get a hip replacement, and then what do you do for housing after that?
Then I do have the $733-something for disability. I'll use that and try and find a room somewhere and get by on that.
All right. Thank you, Dwayne, and good luck to you. I wish you had a little more time for that. That change he was talking about at the Weinberg Center, does that make sense to you?
Yes. Catholic Charities took over operating the shelter.
Oh, I see. So they manage it.
Yes.
I see. And have you seen the improvement that he was talking about? Or?
I have, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Adrian Breidenstein, thanks for being here. It's nice to meet you. Adrian Breidenstein has been, since September 2013, executive director of the Journey Home, which is the name for Baltimore's official plan to end homelessness. Thank you for this update and your insights. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeff, nice to have you on the show. Good old Jeff Singer, former president and CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless, now an adjunct professor at the University of Maryland's School of Social Work. It's been at this a long time. We always appreciate your insights and comments and thoughts on this, Jeff. Thank
and
you.
And your attention. Thank,
yep,
you.
Thank you. Thank you. And please enjoy lunch. We have lunch today from a new provider, Eddie's of Roland Park. Thursday lunch provided by Eddie's of Roland Park, offering catering, gourmet sandwiches, personal shopping, and more at two stores, Roland Avenue and North Charles Street, eddiesofrolandpark.com for directions and menus. Thank you very much. Please stay tuned for the second hour of Midday.